makes you so sure?
Hey, I'm back.
Okay, welcome back after a long hiatus. This is the Constant Content Crisis. I've spent the last 2 years practicing how to say that fluently. What have you been up to, BC Noir?
Oh, watching a lot of content, and when I'm not watching content, I'm trying to write content. And in between that, it's raising kids and trying to maintain my sanity.
Yeah, I heard that. Okay, well, I didn't introduce myself or reintroduce myself. I'm Dr. Welp, not a real doctor, of course, but esteemed nonetheless. And for our return to broadcast, we're just going to be talking about three pieces of content that we've watched in recent weeks, just to kind of get your ears warmed back up to our voices and our voices warmed back up for speaking. So we're going to be discussing three properties for you in this podcast, and I'm going to throw my first pitch straight at my Philadelphia Eagle. I feel like that might be a confusion of sports, but I am English. What have you been watching, BC?
Well, a number of things with the Philadelphians, and there'll be more to come. I think we're trying to rack up all the awards this season. So first up, we have True Detective Night Country. I'm sure many of you have remembered the first three seasons of True Detective. I'm sure not so fondly of the second nor third. However, I know the doctor here really enjoyed the second season, where I kind of wish I weathered and died in that desert as well, just to find my desiccated corpse alongside the less funny Funkhauser. And so now I'm the fourth time's the charm, it seems like. True Detective Night Country seems to be definitely the second best True Detective. They really went back to mine the original lore from the first season. If you remember, the first season was about two detectives chasing down a serial killer and over a number of years, and there was a lot of going back and forth with time and flashbacks. But part of the big hook was the stellar cast, you know. Then the show was headlined by McConaughey and I was going to say the white man that can't jump, Woody Harrelson. So
Woody,
yeah, and
it was
with
the restart. It was the start of the McConaissance, I believe.
Yeah, I think he was on the way to winning an Oscar, an Emmy. I think that was it right that year, but was it Texas Buyers Club that year?
Dallas Buyers Club. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, there you go.
I've never watched it, so I remember the title though.
Yeah. So with that, this show really kind of, as you said, brought him back, and also coming off the back of that movie. With that being said, there was a huge supernatural element to it as well. And with this current season, it really plays up connections between the first season and this season, with hints of the supernatural again, as well as having the titular two detectives. This season is now headlined by Jodie Foster and Kylie Reese. And it's a slow burn, and it takes place in Alaska. Basically, there's in this indigenous community, there's a science research station that has ties to a mine that has been polluting the local community, which has had devastating effects, not just on the human population, but as well as the environment. In the midst of that, several scientists have disappeared, and there's links to the murder of an indigenous woman that occurred years back. But ultimately, the heart of this show to me is just the personal demons that everyone is fighting, and lots of trauma boils to the surface and really impacts these heavily flawed detectives. Again, I think that's true for this series. I mean, everyone kind of comes with their baggage, trying to do the right thing or can't do the right thing, but ultimately it's their humanity that really shines. So with that being said, I think we all are familiar with Jodie Foster and, you know, her, you know, tremendous career starting, you know, going back, I believe she was
Bugsy Malone.
Television. Yeah. Like just, so, you know, was it television? Did she start in television as well?
I think, yeah, I like commercials. She was so right. Young.
So
Alice,
I mean,
doesn't live here anymore. Taxi Driver. Yeah. She did so much when she was a kid.
So, but Taxi Driver was the thing that really like propelled her to major stardom. But before that Oscar winning moment, it was, she was in the industry before that. And I think just with movies like The Accused and Contact, I wouldn't say she, also Silence of the Lambs, of course. So, and with that being said, the showrunner picked in Jodie Foster and wrote this character for her. And I think again, but she's completely different than the character we've seen in Silence of the Lambs. She's like a surly police chief who has suffered devastating loss, and I think is just making her way the best she can. But she's a truly unlikable character, very similar to, I think other characters that we'll discuss later in the podcast, but someone who is kind to a certain extent, but not necessarily nice or pleasant. And I think just, you know, just suffering and punishing herself in certain ways. And then we have Kylie Reese, who plays Evangeline Navarro. Her and Liz Danvers have a really, how would I say? I wouldn't call Navarro a mentee, but there's a relationship that's been established. And again, they have some baggage from an incident that occurred many years before, and they have a truce in order to solve this case. But through this case, they slowly bond. And I would say that Kylie Reese is a really good actress, even though this is like she hasn't been in much. She's a professional boxer who's come from Rhode Island. She's of Cape Verdean and Siikanek Wanapug tribe descent. And I think even though she is not Inuit, she really studied to embody and represent the culture that she was playing for this role. So this show wasn't filmed in Alaska. It was filmed in Reykjavik, Iceland. And they filmed... for 49 nights, but the total shoot took over 120 days. But I would say she really showed her compassion, her boxing skills in the sense that, you know, her real tough exterior. And this is a show that was really trying to showcase how dynamic women can be in lead roles and how tough. And again, you always see the male counterparts, you know, in these roles and with them not taking any shit from anyone. And it's, you know, kind of flips that script. It flips that dynamic, something that we're seeing more and more. But, you know, I would say both of these women have very tough exteriors, really hard to penetrate, but ultimately they're bonding to do the right thing to, you know, solve these murders. It's a great thriller. And then we have, like, again, a tremendous supporting cast. We have John Hawkes as Hank Pryor. He's a senior officer who also has beef with Denver's. Like, it's basically like many people in the community. But he's also menacing as a father, as an officer. So, mm-hmm. And he's the father of Peter Pryor, a young officer and protege. And he's a protege of Danvers. And you can see the jealousy coming from Hank Pryor Sr., the senior officer. And then we also have Christopher Eccleston as Ted Corsero. He's the regional chief of police. And he, again, has history with Danvers, but I would say he's basically like feckless, useless, and a cuck. To put it mildly. But, and then lastly, we have Fiona Shaw, who plays Rose Agnew, and she's a local survivalist. And with her character, she seems to be one that everyone goes to in terms of trying to understand the spiritual nature of the area, and as well as whenever they're in trouble, she's the one that everyone goes to for support. And she has possibly some links to some of the characters from the first season of True Detective.
And she was the kind of mother figure in Andor, right? Fiona Shaw?
She was.
Or am I mistaken? Yeah, okay. So no, American show would be complete without a couple of Brits pretending to be Americans in it.
Well, yeah, well, I would say that's also the same for Finn Bennett, who is also, yes, who's a British actor. He hasn't done much or hasn't really popped up on my radar, but I think you could really empathize with him as he's trying to, you know, make his bones in the police force by adhering to all of Danvers' demands, yet he has this brutal father also in the force, and you can see how his loyalties are divided between family, his father, and the police force. And I would also say that's the same for the three officers. There's a struggle to maintain that balance in terms of being present for your family, solving these crimes, and then the trauma that just ensues with living in this environment and the baggage that just comes with, I would say, just life in general.
It's the first one that's got a subtitle, right? Like the others were just True Detective 1, 2, and 3. I wonder if that's attempt to kind of steer things back on track.
Yeah, because they got rid of they kind of pushed aside Nick Pizzolatto. Who's also publicly kind of came out against this season in some ways. He wasn't happy with some of the connections between the first season. But he's still executive producer, and also McConaughey also helped produce it. So they basically brought in a new showrunner, and her name is Issa Lopez, and she went to HBO. I'm not sure if they tapped her, but anyway, they came. Her and HBO came up with a new, a new trajectory for True Detective. So at the end of the opening credits, they call her created. So she created this season. So she went and developed all this on her own. I don't think she had much to do with Nick Palazzo, but I think what she did was pretty incredible. It's a bit of a slow burn at first. I had my doubts, especially at the beginning of this second episode, because, I mean, there's some very grotesque images. And I, you know, it seems to be, you know, a bit for shock value to a certain extent, but I think they really brought it home with the last episode. It reminded me a bit of The Mayor of Easttown, where there's tons of red herrings and initially I think I was a bit disappointed, but I think in terms of the true reveal of what had happened and what was happening in the community was pretty shocking and amazing. And and I think it was a bit of the same feel as The Mayor of Easttown, where I think the final revelations really like brings it all home and in some shocking ways.
So okay.
I would say if you're in for some suspense, supernatural horror or supernatural horror adjacent, and some really, really broken characters that you learn to care about and to cheer for and I think and empathize with in many ways, I think True Detective really brought it back to this season really brought True Detective back to prominence.
Yeah, I meant to watch the third series and never got around to it. I've meant to return to the first series for many years. If I can find the time, maybe I'll return to the first series and then give this one a go. Because the first series was definitely like a gripping show when it was on. It kind of came out of the blue, it felt. I suppose the average Inuit diet consists of a fair few red herrings.
And caribou, I'm sure. And whale.
Yeah. Red caribous. That could be, you know, maybe we can start something there.
Well, it starts off with some caribou. So there you go.
I love a caribou. You know, it's one of my favorite Pixies songs. Anything more to add on True Detective? Night Country.
I don't really think I did it justice. I'm really holding back. I think it's better if you go in watching this show without knowing anything and just following that journey along with the detectives. There's just so much there to unpack in between. So the environmental themes, the way that we've treated our indigenous people comes to the forefront, as well as not just with indigenous people, but just across the board in terms of the impact of mining and and that runoff and how it destroys communities. But there's some things that are even bigger than that that comes up in the show. And that really reminds me of Smilla's Sense of Snow. I prefer the novel more so than the movie, but there are some echoes to that as well. So there's a lot of things that Lopez put together to create this beautifully horrific package of a TV series. If we were doing a spoiler review, it'll be a little bit different, but I would say it's better to go in cold.
No pun intended. Do you think Lopez is a big fan of the Steven Seagal movie On Deadly Ground? Because it sounds like it covers some similar territory. Again, no pun intended.
Looking at what I saw, I doubt it. Seriously, I don't know how many she wrote it. I think she wanted to make a show from a female perspective, and I'm sure On Deadly Ground is the complete opposite of what she was trying to make. I think really being able to bring Jodie Foster on board, you know, was a great catch. And then picking someone who's not highly prominent in the acting world, like Reese, who I think it's probably my favorite character in the show. For someone who comes from the boxing world, who's just starting to cut their teeth on acting, and just to be able to show such strength, brutality, and vulnerability, it's amazing. And just also being so nurturing with some of the other characters. And where I think Jodie Foster, where you have this image of Clarice from Silence of the Lambs, where she's just, I wouldn't call her menacing, just someone brutal to be around. Someone who just doesn't give a shit about anyone or anything, or at least puts on that air to her detriment and pushing everyone away. I think Lopez really knows how to create believable women, even though we hardly see them on the screen. I think just trying to bring that to the forefront.
And does Reese, I mean, this might be a spoiler, does she save Sarah Connor in the end?
I think she's capable of saving Sarah Connor.
Okay, well, there you go. You know, I mean, there's your next hard reboot of Terminator. Let's get Kylie Reese.
Well, you
got to
wait another 20 years. That's right.
All right, okay. Yeah, I'll definitely check it out. I'm a simple man. I like films and thrillers that are set in the snow. It doesn't really take much more to hook me. So as soon as I saw some of the promotional material for this, I was, you know, it went onto my list. But it's a big list. Maybe to not so neatly segue into my next idea. One of the big issues that we probably always have is what we can watch in front of our children. I don't think my boys are ready for True Detective Night Country yet, but I did sit down and watch Army of Darkness with my youngest son yesterday, actually. And I was a little bit apprehensive at first because I thought, how much does this go into the kind of Evil Dead, Deadite, zombie lore? But after the first few minutes, which just does the customary recap of what goes on in the cabin in the woods, it's basically just a very short, rollicking, kind of hilarious ride throughout. And yeah, absolutely, if you're not too afraid of a bit of cartoonish violence and a few gallons of blood being thrown around, then I'd say it's fine to watch with a younger audience. It's very funny. Bruce Campbell is at his most swaggering, peacockish, and ridiculous. And, you know, the film is all the better for it because he pushes it so hard that it's the kind of ridiculous macho role that, you know, in contemporary times stands as a parody, really, which, of course, it was back in 1993 as well. But yeah, I'm happy to say it still stands up. I mean, it's here and gone in, I think, 80 minutes, which seems insane when you consider the bloated runtimes of some movies. And I was prompted to watch it because I watched Evil Dead Rise the other day, and it was a good movie, but it just wasn't really much fun. And my memory of the Evil Dead films was that they were, you know, entertaining, silly, almost more like slapstick Looney Tunes cartoons in real life. And yeah, I was kind of hankering for that. And it dawned on me that it might be something I could watch with my children. And yeah, lo and behold, it was. There's probably the only thing I would censor at this stage is a couple of dated uses of the word bitch that maybe don't really stand up by today's standards. But, you know, you can forgive him. He's an unreconstructed 80s male that works in an S-Mart. So,
well, you know, Freddy Krueger said it best. Welcome to prime time, bitch. You know, exactly, there's a good way to...
You can't top that.
No. No, you can't.
Yeah, it gets thrown around. It gets thrown around so much then. It's subtle, actually, but it's interesting how... Like, obviously, a character like Freddy Krueger saying it is very much, you know, you'd expect this is the villain, this is someone that's murdering people. But it was interesting how jarred I was by hearing, like, you know, the protagonist say it to the love interest, you know, or you know, like, he just kind of throws it around a bit and it's like, okay, you can't just be calling all women bitches, Ash. Like, it's not okay anymore.
what's the term? Is it unreconstructed male? Is that what you...
That's what I said. I think that's a thing.
Yeah.
I think, you know, just like a sort of intentionally old-fashioned kind of, you know, stubble-wearing Marlboro man kind of going out of their way to not be, I don't know.
Look, some women, you know, long for the days for men to be real men, you know, so, you know, they can always find an Ash somewhere, you know, maybe they can look on YouTube and some podcast to listen to and find an, you know, I'm sure
absolutely,
they're still out there somewhere.
I think I've only profited from the, you know, the relative drop off of the unreconstructed male, because I must be very just reconstructed, you know, like I can't do anything. I certainly can't light a match off of my face.
Well, even I, you know, someone like, there's a horror podcast out there and I dropped a GIF and that, you know, that Freddy Krueger GIF with that quote. And then I had to, you know, labor over it. Do I put this up? Cause I mean, like, honestly, I don't know if people, still say that in movies, or is it even still, you know, you hear people say it, but like still, like, you know, it's the same with cigarettes and flicks, etc. Can you still say bitch? Is that still acceptable? Yep. So
it's interesting how it changes, because I feel like there's visceral dismemberment in a police procedural now beyond the level of anything we saw in most horror films in the 80s. But yeah. And I mean, I'm not against it. Like, this is, I have no issue with it. I think used well, it absolutely fits a certain type of character. But yeah, it was just interesting to me. That was the bit that stood out. None of the beheadings or, you know, the kind of cartoonish violence. It was just when he called the woman a bitch, I was just, oh, don't listen to that bit, son. Yeah, that's no way to treat a lady. But no, it was a lot of fun. I would, you know, I won't labor on it, but it's been one of my favorites for many years. It's daft as a brush, but it has a touch of the Monty Python to it in some ways. I think it, you know, it kind of is vaguely reminiscent of things like Holy Grail and Jabberwocky, and it's interesting to go back to that film so many years later and realize, you know, Sam Raimi was quite brave when he was still a relatively new filmmaker to just make a film, you know, set in the medieval times with zombie monsters. Like, there wasn't a lot of stuff like that going on at the time. And I think it's easy to forget, you know, like, I don't know if he blazed a trail, but he blazed something.
No, I think he did, you know, like, I think just that Ash character, like, I really loved Evil Dead 2. That was always on USA up all night. I would watch that all the time. I still haven't, or maybe I blocked out watching the original Evil Dead. I mean, I remember parts, but I mean, that, what I remember was just so gory and dark and troubling that I never went back to it. But I love the second movie. And then, I saw Army of Darkness in the theaters. And that was something that, you know, again, on cable, I watched on repeat. But I do think that those movies, and, well, especially Ash, I think, you know, like, I guess it's kind of like Jack Burton from Big Trouble in Little China.
Right.
And then I think those types of characters you see over and over, like the Han Solo type, I would say. Mm-hmm. Not so much as, you know, that great genre blending that he's done with, like, you know, humor and horror and action. I think that's, you know, that's hard to nail. Some of these things you kind of see now and again, but I think that Ash character, Like, I think he really started that, I would say, fine tune that trend from what we got with Solo to someone who, as you said, more buffoonish and cartoonish, but still lovable.
Right. Yeah, totally. It's Jack Burton is a great nod as well. Definitely this awareness of the ridiculousness of that kind of character, but you still rooted for them because the buffoonery gives them that touch of vulnerability. You know, you can tell that it's important for these guys to be observed being heroic, and you usually see a hint of fear in them at some point when they don't think anyone's looking, which, you know, makes them, even as cartoonish characters, quite relatable. And, you know, Bruce Campbell was such a wonderful just concept for so many years as well, because, you know, he was just a friend of Sam Raimi's, and it seemed for a while he was only really in Evil Dead movies, and, you know, clearly an incredibly talented performer, and so physical, you know, and yet he never really seemed to propel to stardom in anything else. I know he did a couple of long running TV shows that maybe didn't land on the other side of the pond quite so well, but, and a few cameos here and there, but, you know, he never really topped Ash. But, you know, who wants to top Ash? You know, I mean, like he peaked young. Well, Army of Darkness, watch it with your kids. You know, don't worry about it. Tell them Dr. Welp prescribed it.
Yeah, I might start with Evil Dead 2. We'll see how long that'll last. Yeah, they saw a little bit of True Detective, and I kind of, I'm kind of now just not turning the channel or turning off the TV. But so they'll get an eyeful of that, or like Tokyo Vice here and there. But I think it's, you know, they're at an age, and I guess this is me growing up in the 80s, used to seeing all sorts of things and just unrestricted. And I think they can handle it. And if they can't, they'll just walk out the room. They'll have to just,
My last note really on the Evil Dead films is, for the longest time, I think even the poster for this movie, Army of Darkness, on VHS, at least in the UK, it's not the ridiculous kind of cartoonish hero poster that you generally see nowadays. It's a more serious looking thing, and I would say that all three of these movies, the video cover art or the poster art was a lot scarier than the actual content. And, you know, Evil Dead 2, I guess it was almost part of the joke, the marketing campaign for it, you know, like, this is such an intense, terrifying movie. And, you know, when I finally got around to watching it, I was like, this isn't a comedy. Like, this isn't horrific in the slightest. It's ridiculous, but it's an amazing comedy. And in a way, you know, I don't know if they sold themselves short or if they really maybe lost a bit of an audience, but it's hard to explain maybe to younger people just how important the poster was for, you know, the advertising of a movie in the 80s. And I'm sure in the decades before, you know, that was sometimes the only form of media that you had that gave you any idea about what a film was. And I grew up thinking that Evil Dead movies would be terrifying, that the Nightmare on Elm Street movies would be terrifying. The poster art is something that was definitely more important. Now, you know, a year before a film's come out, you've got, you know, advanced teasers and people discussing casting, and people know more about a film before it's been made than I feel like we knew about films when they'd been out for 4 or 5 years. And the poster art and the video art was so powerful that I had no idea that these films were in the least bit comedic. And even the first Evil Dead movie, if you go back to it, is, you know, probably more cartoonish than you remember. I mean, there's definitely some nasty stuff in Evil Dead 1, but there's also some crazy, like, stop motion ridiculousness. Yeah, I think, again, I don't know if it's better or worse, but it was certainly different. I spent so much time sifting through the video boxes in all my local video shops, and generally what I had in my imagination ended up being a lot more terrifying than the movie that I eventually watched. Like, I kind of learned that the horror genre is, certainly in the 80s at least, was usually laden with a lot of comedy and hijinks and kind of ridiculous action set pieces, and seldom was it actually that scary.
Yeah, well, I mean, this reminds me of the Stuff, where I saw went to the movies and I saw the poster with this white stuff coming out of someone's eyes and mouth, and it mortified me. I hated things like The Blob, and I know, I guess what little I've seen since then, I'm sure it's like a pretty funny comedy, like a comedy horror, but I still don't have an interest in watching it. But that, you
That's
know,
good. It's still got the power.
Yeah. I mean, if I have to, but like, I agree. Like, I think, growing up, depending on what you saw in posters, like, that was the only avenue of knowing what a movie was about, because you didn't have internet. You didn't have like stuff blasting in your eyeballs or in your pocket, you know, blaring all the time. Either you might have caught a commercial, or you've seen a trailer while you were in the theater. But if you didn't have that, or as you said, like if you're like, you know, going through a video rental shop, you can see all the covers to the boxes and what have you. But you just didn't have access to all that information. Sometimes, now it's too much, or, you know, to its detriment. And I think you need to make a real concerted effort to not be spoiled by something.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. You got to keep yourself pure.
I haven't seen any movies from the new Evil Dead franchise. They look really disgusting and horrifying. But from what I understood, the second one was supposedly really good, even though you said it's, from what you insinuated, I didn't think you had that same take. And also, I think they're trying to build a bigger franchise out of it now. Like more movies to come, or spinoffs coming. So, but what is your take on that compared to the original Evil Dead trilogy so far? Or, and also there's the Evil Dead TV shows, right?
Yeah, now I haven't actually watched the Evil Dead TV shows, which I don't know. They've kind of been distantly on my radar for a long time. But then there's also that, there's always that part of me that thinks, is this going to be too much? Like, you know, we've already talked at length about the character of Ash, but sometimes I feel like three movies is kind of enough. Let the rest just lie, and let's just leave that character where it was. I did watch the remake of Evil Dead, which must be about 10 years ago now. And I think, was that directed by Fede Alvarez? I think perhaps I'll have to fact check that one, but you know, this is a pretty notable contemporary horror director. It was good. It was very dark, but the issue I have with this film and with Evil Dead Rise is just they removed to me the bit that makes the Evil Dead movies different to other horror movies, which is what we were just talking about, the kind of sense of humor, the zaniness, the kind of blend of gore with not just comedy, but, you know, this kind of physical performance. They're fine as just straight horror movies. And Evil Dead Rise was not a bad film by any means. Incidentally, I don't think there's any connection between the two, unless I'm greatly mistaken. It was just very serious and mined things like, you know, issues between families and motherhood and brothers and sisters. And it was interesting stuff, but I just, you know, I thought it was going to be an Evil Dead movie like the Evil Dead movies that I grew up with. So, you know, it would be like someone taking, I don't know, Dumb and Dumber but redoing it as like a serious film about two men with, you know, mental disabilities. You know, like, I'm sure it could be an interesting film, but if I went in thinking it was going to be Dumb and Dumber, I'd probably be a little knocked. Maybe that's a bit extreme, but there were some great moments in it. Evil Dead Rise had an amazing scene of someone being, I guess, possessed by the Deadites or by the Book of the Dead. And it was, you know, like very visceral, kind of very powerful stuff, but it's just not really what I was there for. I, you know, I'm a strong believer in the fact that if you're a capable storyteller, you should be able to get your story off the ground without the assistance of a franchise. And maybe I'm naive, but if this movie hadn't been anything to do with Evil Dead, I think I might have perceived it quite differently. But other than, you know, the Necronomicon being the kind of inciting incident for the story, there's really nothing to do with Evil Dead in Evil Dead Rise at all. You know, it's not even like a cabin in the woods kind of vibe. It's an urban setting, which again, that's not a problem, but yeah, I don't know. Its links to the Evil Dead are so tenuous that it could have just been a movie in its own right. But I understand how powerful franchises are, and I probably wouldn't have watched it if it wasn't Evil Dead Rise. So you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't.
Evil Dead Rise looks like it was directed by Lee Cronin.
That's right, yeah, yeah. I was thinking of the reboot from about 10 years ago.
Yeah, but that was Alvarez.
That was Alvarez, who's doing the new Alien movie, which I'm sure will be interesting too. But yeah, yeah, and he did Don't Breathe, which was a cool film.
Yep.
The reboot of Evil Dead was fine. It was very serious, and they kind of, I seem to recall that they tied, like, it was a girl going cold turkey or something, and that's why they'd taken her out to the cabin in the woods. And it just immediately stepped out of that kind of camp that I enjoyed from the original movies, you know. I think what they were really trying to do with these two movies was deliver on the original promise from those old posters in the 80s of the Evil Dead movies, which was, this is the most intense, terrifying thing you're ever going to see. And of course it wasn't, you know. But who knows? Who knows?
And sorry, one more question. Which ending do you prefer? For Army
Great Death? Question. Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, because I didn't know which one I was going to get. I couldn't remember which version I had. And as I was nearing the end, I thought to myself, my son is going to laugh more at the overslept ending, which looks like it was achieved for about $5.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
It's never made sense to me how he goes back in time and he's in medieval England, but, you know, who cares, right? And then we ended up with the S-Mart ending, which actually he thought was hilarious because he really likes guns. I grew up with the oversleeping ending. I don't think I saw the S-Mart ending until I was about 25.
Really? Because you're right. That's the director's cut ending, right? I mean, that's the extra footage is the Rip Van Winkle ending. But that's the one you grew up with.
Which means, so I don't know. I think it was the international release. I'm sure that's the one we got on VHS in England. Because, which makes sense, because I guess the whole S-Mart vibe is a bit more, you know, I mean, I understand how your guys' shops work, but I think maybe 30, 40 years ago, that would have been a little bit obscure to a British audience. Like, what's going on here? So they threw in the ending, which feels a bit more, again, it feels closer to like Time Bandits or Monty Python or something, right? You know, but it's a bit of a mean ending, I always think, for a jolly film. I always felt bad for him.
So which ending do you prefer for what is it, Little Shop of Horrors?
Oh golly, I didn't know there were multiple.
Yeah, there was.
What's the other ending for Little Shop of Horrors?
Wow, it was pretty horrifying, actually, and it's one where the test audience really got upset, and so they had to redo it, and that's why when you see the singers at the end, not all of them could come back, so you only see the legs.
I'm gonna have to.
Oh, you never seen it? It's about, I don't know, it's about 10, I don't know how, 5 minutes, 7 minutes. It's long and intense, and I was pretty nuts. Yeah, it's pretty long. It's completely different. It's not like one segment. It's just an alternative ending. Period. Not like, I guess I would say, like a tag. That's interesting. For
we watched
Darkness,
right? No, we watched Little Shop of Horrors over the winter holidays, actually, and the boys really enjoyed that. They particularly, Audrey 2's foul-mouthed singing. I've heard the expression tough titty a lot in my house since watching Little Shop of Horrors. You know, you've got to learn it somewhere. But that's another one that I would say, you know, if you're looking for a bit of nostalgia, that's a fun one to watch with the kids. And the songs are great. Like, I've been listening to the soundtrack for the last month because the singers in that movie are amazing. So apart from the woman who plays Audrey, I cannot bear her voice. It goes through me. I think it's meant to be very nasal on purpose, but yeah. it really, I can't bear it. I prefer Rick Moranis.
Is her name Green?
I can't remember her name. It's Green, Ellen Green.
Yeah, because she was also on, what is it called? Pushing Daisies.
She's a great singer. I mean, you can tell she's fully in control of her voice. I just don't like the voice that she's doing in that film. Like, she's doing a parody of this kind of 50s, yeah. you know, gang mall. And she really gets into it to a degree that's, yeah, kind of like nails on a chalkboard. So... I would have fed her to Audrey too, which would have been kind of a fitting irony. But anyway, we digress. There's a third one. All right, what else have you been watching? I know you're itching to talk about the next thing.
Am I? Mr. and Mrs. Smith.
The Community movie or something to do with the Community movie?
Yeah, that's right. What is it? Five seasons in a movie? Six seasons in a movie. Mr. and Mrs. Smith. This was a pleasant surprise. This is something I was really waiting for. Basically, it's not a remake, it's a reimagining of the Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt flick, which I've never seen and never really had any interest.
Me neither.
You're just looking at the posters and the trailers, and I just thought, this is not for me. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, what is his name? Right now, I think it like, oh, yeah, he's like, you know, he worked on Rebels. Kinberg? Simon Kinberg. Is that Kinberg, right? Simon Kinberg, writer, director?
That rings a vague bell, but not a loud bell.
But I think that's how he got into the industry, was I think writing this movie.
I see.
And but I think it was the original draft where the premise for the movie was that it's about this married assassins who go to like couples counseling together.
Right.
So
that's cute.
But this, I would say this is, this show primarily focuses on the relationship between two assassins who, again, work for an unnamed company or government agency and are paired together to be Mr. and Mrs. Smith and go on assignments together. And as they... live in this nice, beautiful, really expensive home in New York, grow to love each other and really establish a genuine relationship. And you see the ups and downs of that relationship. And that seems to be more what hooked me to the show. And I would also say in the show, there's missions, there's action. I think some of the... especially the episode that Donald Glover directed himself. So that was the season finale. Just the physicality between both of them is quite amazing. But it's not, if you're looking for something like Mission Impossible or The Bourne Flicks, you're not going to get that. It's a bit more grounded in terms of the action and the fighting. But the heart of it is this relationship between this couple. And I think, you know, some of the slights, some of the small things that happened, some of the communication said and unsaid, and also childhood trauma or dysfunctional families come into play. And you just see how all that seeps in slowly in the relationship, and just have these two polar opposites coming together and trying to complete missions or failing at missions and trying to, and then still try to maintain this relationship professionally and personally. Like Donald Glover, from what I understand, since I didn't see, I've never seen Atlanta. From what I gather, it's a lot of people have said that this is similar to Atlanta in terms of the quirkiness and some of the conversations that like occur. But I really, really watched it for Maya Erskine, and she's she was one of the stars of Pin 15, which I would say is a live action version of that Netflix show, that animated Netflix series about puberty.
Big Mouth.
So, and I watched a couple episodes of Pin 15. I really loved Pin 15, what little I saw, but it's also fairly disturbing when you have these two older women playing their middle school selves with a lot of hormones raging, and they're also playing themselves amongst other middle schoolers. It's something I want to go back to, but you know, I think at times it's just so hard to watch. But in saying that, I've watched it for her because she did an incredible job on Blue Eyes Samurai. And I've only known her from Pin 15. And just seeing her range in this show is amazing. Also, she's not the typical leading woman, which is also great. She's like, neither of these characters are anything like, you know, or actors, I should say, anything like Brad Pitt or Angelina Jolie. That if that's what you're looking for, this is not the show for you. This is really a show about like just character development and with a lot of like humor and a lot of pain. And I think a lot of familiarity for couples. I think these are the things you do. It's not so broad. It's the small things. But yeah, well, as what Donald Glover was trying to bring to the table was trying to have a group of showrunners that were all female, again, to remove the male gaze. The showrunner was also was one of the writers that he brought from Atlanta. I believe the only male, well, the only males in the writer room were probably him and his brother, which Donald Glover tends to collaborate with his brother a lot in all these projects. So, and then the supporting cast is amazing. Alexander Skarsgård, Iza Gonzalez, Paul Dano, John Turturro, Sharon Horgan, Billy Campbell, Parker Posey, Wagner Moreau, Ron Perlman, Sarah Paulson, and my favorite was Michelle Cole. I'd never seen I Will Destroy You. That's always been on my list. But just out of the supporting characters, I think for me, she was the standout. I can't praise the show enough. I don't think it's for everyone. But for me, I think it was very engrossing. It, I typically don't binge shows, but this is something that I watched like every night for a week. And I truly, truly like felt for these characters and could empathize with these characters, where you have Mrs. Smith being very the cold, calculating, more skilled, manipulative of the couple. And then you have Mr. Smith, who's kind of like go with the flow, not as savvy, and one to quickly fall head over heels. So just seeing that dynamic as well, where that struggle between her expectations and his, not just with relationships, but also with the job. And since the stakes are high, since there are assassins, so much fun to watch. I mean, not just the humor, but just the painful elements of watching these people try to maintain their job and their lives in the midst of this whirlwind romance.
Is there likely to be a second series of this, or is it a one-off, do you think?
Well, I hope there's a lot of eyeballs on this to warrant a second season. So I'm not sure how it's doing in the ratings. Donald Glover went into this knowing that people would compare it to the original and initially turn off. He's not a big fan of reboots or remakes. So he knew this, there would be skepticism. But also, I think his whole purpose was to kind of, one, not make a remake, and two, to prove people wrong.
Right.
And then initially he was supposed to collaborate with his robot counterpart from Solo, and also the next Indiana Jones, and her name is
Phoebe Waller-Bridge.
There you go.
She's the next Indiana Jones?
Well, I think that was probably the point, wasn't it, from the last movie?
Interesting. That's a whole other conversation. That's not me being like, you know, I'm fine with there being a female Indiana Jones. I really like Phoebe Waller-Bridge, but I really didn't like her in Indiana Jones.
No,
it's not a good movie. I just don't think she fit in that world. But I loved her in Solo, actually. I thought she was really funny in that.
And I've never seen Fleabag. So again, another one on a long list of things to watch.
Oh, Fleabag's great. Yeah, very good.
So basically, from what I understood, they had a Phoebe Waller-Bridge and Donald Glover had an amicable divorce over making the show. I think she wanted to come in, and I don't know how true this is, but he basically said in the UK, they don't have writer's rooms. So I think it was about her wanting to have more prominence in terms of the direction of the show. And I think they decided to uncouple in terms of this project. And then he reached out to Myra Erskine. And Donald Glover's mother was on Pin 15 at some point. So as well as Erskine's mother as well. Yeah, he reached out to Maya and she happily accepted. And I watched probably all the junkets and interviews they had together because I was just fascinated by the chemistry that they had. And you could see it on and off the screen. And it was just always entertaining to watch them together and their dynamic. In some ways, it was very similar to what you saw on the show in terms of how they go about things. So I think that was a huge draw, just the chemistry that they had.
Another TV show added to the list. Okay, let's stick with TV. I'll definitely check out Mr. and Mrs. Smith, but I'll be honest, not having been a fan of the, or being a watcher of the original film, I really don't have I've got nothing built up about Mr. and Mrs. Smith. But based on your recommendation, I'll definitely check it out. The next thing on my list is another one of your recommendations that I did get around to watching after about 6 months, which was The Bear, which I watched back to back over the last month or so. So I just finished the second series. I think on Friday night we sat down and we watched three episodes back to back because, you know, it was impossible not to. And yeah, I'll try and speak as well as you do about TV shows without giving anything away. But suffice to say, over the two seasons of The Bear, there's a heck of a lot of ups and downs. There's a lot of growth and then regression. There's moments of incredible tears of joy-inducing hope in the simplest of things. And then there's the flip side of that, the depth of issues that people can carry with them in life and how they are. We're often told with motivational speaking that, you know, just work hard, believe in yourself, and you can make it happen. And I definitely think that is at the core of this story, but it's also a realistic story. And sometimes you can do all those things and it might still not happen, or something bad might just happen on the path to that going on. So it really runs the gamut of emotions as a show, and generally manages to do it in 30 minutes or less, which is quite impressive because that is probably a running time that's more usually associated with situation comedy, which I would say this show most certainly is not. It is funny, hilarious at times, but it's definitely the kind of humor that I think emerges in reality rather than scripted humor. Speaking of chemistry, there is one episode, which, you know, I won't delve too deeply into, but there's a couple of actors that, you know, the cameos in this show are amazing, and I won't spoil them, because if you're like me, you enjoy someone popping up that you really didn't expect to see. But there's an actor that comes into it playing the wife of one of the main characters in the show. They really don't have a lot of time on screen together, but there's one sequence where they're together, and it's, you know, it's so convincing. These two actors that you've not even seen share the screen before, but they're so close, and it's, yeah, it's quite incredible, really, the amount of believability that they built up, you know, and just the things that they do, the way that they speak, the kind of, I guess for a period in time, it was called like mumblecore, you know, like there's a lot of that just kind of unfinished sentences, but it was just so real. And this show can really draw on that quite often. It really goes there, you know, like with extreme examples of reality, and then it will really crank things up, you know, as you might expect in a show about cooking. You know, there are some intense kitchen-based right. scenes and cooking and eating becomes, you know, a metaphor for other things. But yeah, without wanting to give anything away, this is a show that is amazingly acted. You could take your pick, really. The leading actor, Jeremy Allen White, is very good. I still am in two minds about how much I really like his character, but I've kind of done, you know, gone up and down with his character. I think he's someone that's definitely got deep issues that need to be worked on, and I think we do see him working on those things throughout the series. Ayo Edebiri, as the kind of almost undefeatable Sydney, who's just working so hard to make something happen, but again, is not above moments of short-sightedness and pig-headedness and arrogance, you know, but also is so grounded and just such a wonderful blend of, again, so many relatable things. You know, I think that the thing about this show is that the mistakes that most of the characters make, you can relate to, you know, you can really empathize with. Yeah, I mean, I could talk about it at length if I could talk about it
right.
more openly. Well, but yeah, I mean, I know you love this show, so please jump in.
No, I mean, some of the things we will discuss and what we are discussing is, like, you know, big part of it is generational trauma, right? Mm-hmm. And that, you know, comes up big time in The Bear. It's funny. Yeah. And then also I would say that one of the headlines for Mr. and Mrs. Smith was a mumblecore romance with assassins. So maybe that, you know, don't know where to begin with The Bear. For me personally, as you said, I can empathize with a lot of characters in the show, as well as the scenario of being, like, you know, in workplaces where it sometimes it feels like a pressure cooker, and
right.
you see so many people that have so much potential, and they just need that person to come in and really shake things up, or to harness that potential, or help move propel the staff in the right direction. And as you said, with the main character, he's tremendously troubled, but he's always trying to do the right thing in spite of what has happened to him in the past, as well as struggling in the present. And it's also nice to see something that's real is someone fall on their face and fail. But then that failing is them actually doing something, and that perseverance. But it's crushing, soul crushing. Yeah. And he's not the only character like that. Also, I think this show showcases people who are, you know, who have savior complexes, or our characters, or that I would say is more and more what we're seeing is the lost men who just feel out of place, lost in the world that's changed and kind of left them behind. And you just see there's the potential and the hope that you see in these characters, and just watching their evolution and watching them grow and change and struggle or simply give up.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then if they do give up, will other people like give, you know, throw them a lifeline? I think there's so much that's relatable for viewers in the show on so many different levels where they can identify themselves or see aspects of themselves in this show. But I do feel, in spite of how bleak and crazy things are, there is a sense of hope. And I think that's, you know, that what keeps people coming. And failure is real. So then how do you survive that? How do you deal with that? Because some of the characters on and off screen have failed and truly given up. Mm. And that leaves a lasting impact on the people or on the characters in this show. What happens when you are left behind? And how do you deal with that? And how do you keep on going? Or how do you keep on motivating others? And then you have, I would say all these shows that we discussed, you know, maybe not so much like Army of Darkness per se, but you're seeing like it's about that growth and moving beyond the baggage that they come with.
Yeah.
So but then with this, you do have that beautiful, shiny exterior of the food, the cooking, the frantic nature of the restaurant business, you know, all the beautiful obscenities that come out through in the show. And it's extremely entertaining in the middle of all this. And I think that's a big part of what we're talking about is how do you showcase trauma, or how do you showcase like environmental issues? How do you showcase being accepted anymore, or not having the skill set to survive anymore in a beautifully entertaining package? Because I think that's the way people, modern audiences and probably audiences of many generations take in serious issues or can see their lives reflected, you know, it has to be in an entertaining manner, or it has to be in a shiny package where it's not just stark. You know, it's hard for people to look in the mirror that way. So I think these are brilliant inroads for possibly self-reflection and change, and also just extremely entertaining. I couldn't praise this show enough. I mean, it is amazing. I think it's going to be the next succession in terms of the sweeps of all the awards. We've already seen that starting, and it's just continuing. Yeah. So hopefully that this next season can surpass or maintain the level of quality and excellence the first two seasons have managed to muster. I think, as you said, the supporting actors, like, you know, just like it's astounding, like the caliber and quality of actors that they managed to bring into the show, even for 15 minutes or at a time or just for an episode. It's truly amazing, but it's a must watch for me. You know, I would say it's up, even though it's not on HBO, it's HBO quality, but it's amongst the pantheons of like some of the best TV shows we've seen in the past 20 years, if you ask me. Yeah. It's highly recommended.
No, I agree. Again, it's just one to go and watch. And like you say, in terms of the shiny package, you know, it's got an amazing soundtrack. The use of music, the repetition of certain songs to tie in with certain moods. There's like a certain song that I don't think it's an original composition. I think it's, you know, it's a track that they've found, but they kind of use it whenever the kitchen's really motivated and they've got to cook something quickly. And, you know, it's simple stuff, but it does, you know, it gets the heart beating. And we've always enjoyed looking at amazing food being prepared. I mean, it's in a way, it probably taps into the same audience that likes Gordon Ramsay's Kitchen Nightmares in a way. You know, he comes in and he tells a restaurant how to sort its act out. this is very similar, you know, just with a bit more pleasant drama thrown in to make it a little bit more palatable. But both seasons surprise me just in terms of the actual scope of, you know, the direction of the show, not in a plot twist kind of way. I just expected it to be a little bit different, you know, the focus of the first series and the focus of the second series. So they've left themselves with a lot of mileage. You know, I think there's a lot that they can do in terms of, you know, the central point of this show or the central forum of this show is a restaurant. And we've already seen it in different states, shall we say, throughout the first two seasons. So yeah, I'm intrigued to see where they go with it, and I hope they can keep it up. But definitely, if you haven't, go and watch it, because otherwise it'll be one of those shows that, you know, you hear everyone talking about and you'll be kicking yourself that you didn't watch it. And as I say, it's so short.
Yep.
You know, you could get it done in a fortnight, no problem.
Yeah, exactly. I missed out on the first season when it originally aired, but it's one of those shows that just kept popping up. And then once they announced the second season, I binged the first season, and it like nicely bled right into the second season when it started. Yeah, it's an astounding show. And some of the faces you recognize, some of you don't in terms of the main cast, but
yeah,
it's some of these people, you'll see them around and like in smaller features or TV shows. Even one of the characters I saw on the latest episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm, which was kind of shocking.
Okay.
But it's definitely worth the watch.
Yep. Excellent. Okay. That's a two thumbs up, to coin an old phrase from both of us. Okay. Well, then the last thing, I think we're both going to discuss the same movie, right? Alexander Payne's The Holdovers, which we both watched more or less in the last week or so. So why don't you start us off? Tell us about The Holdovers, BC.
The Holdovers is a movie that Alexander Payne was trying to make, probably for about two decades, and just couldn't get around to it. So when the screenwriter David Hammondson sent him a pitch for a TV show, Payne was basically told him, "I don't want to make your show, but I like the premise of your show," which is basically about, Hammondson was trying to make a show about his life in boarding school. However, since Payne was trying to make something similar, because he was a fan of this 1935 French film about a teacher who had to watch one student over vacation during his tenure at a boarding school. And this teacher also had a very bad eye. So they loosely adapted that. However, every time Hammondson submitted his script, I believe that Payne ripped it apart and then added his notes, and this became a deeply personal movie for both of them, where you're taking some of the lives of Hammondson, and then you're also taking Payne's experience growing up in going to high school at an all-boys school. And literally quoting some of the things that their teachers have told them and their experiences. And so in the part of the big draw to this movie is that it's set in the 70s, and Payne always wanted to make a movie set in the 70s. So he made a contemporary movie with all the wrappings of 70s movies, from the intro to all the credits. All of it just takes you back to what you've seen in the 70s, and even the way he, even the type of film he used to make the movie. I mean, it comes off as authentic. I would go into some of the things, the reasons why I would say it's more contemporary than the 70s, which is kind of on its face. But I mean, I'll bring that up later. But basically, yeah, this is such a heartwarming movie. And Payne really wanted his friend Paul Giamatti to star in this movie. They first collaborated almost 20 years ago on Sideways, which I loved at the time.
Yeah.
And they just never managed to find the time to work together and until this movie. And like the, again, there's not a lot of big name actors aside from Giamatti, but Divine Joy Randolph. She's amazing in this flick, and in Payne saw her from My Name is Dolomite, and he went like, and just based on what she brought to the table in that show, I mean that movie. And I know only know her from, I vaguely remember that movie, and I know her from Only Murders in the Building. He brought her on board to play the head of the kitchen staff, and then you have Dominique Sessa, the lone student that he had to oversee during this winter vacation. And he plays, so Sessa plays Tully Angus, and Paul Giamatti plays Hunnam.
Yeah.
And so Tully Angus and Hunnam in this unfortunate situation grow and bond during his vacation, because these are two extremely unlikable characters, where Tully plays a student clearly who wants to go home during a vacation, but it's also very unpleasant and full of snark, full of attitude, has a huge chip on his shoulder, challenges authority and everyone around him. And then you have Hunnam, who students hate. Staff members don't like him. He's extremely intelligent. I believe he's kind, but he's also someone else who's not very nice, who smells like fish and has a bad eye. He truly repels people on so many levels. He's someone you feel for. He's very similar to the character that Giamatti played in Sideways, but I think he's but a bit more assertive. Someone who closes himself off because he's self-aware enough to know how he's viewed by others, but he's also knows how intelligent he is and what he has to offer others. And he's also has high expectations of others, and for better, for worse, he stands his ground in terms of his attitude and temperament towards the people around him, whether it repels them or not. But he's on a mission to educate, because he knows his worth. And I think, and where Telly's also extremely intelligent and has a lot to offer, but again, repels others. And I think you have these two people in a situation where they bond at this empty boarding school over the winter holiday. And Divine Joy Randolph is a part of this trio, and it's also suffering in her own ways. And I'm not sure how much I should say about her situation, but just seeing her journey and her roller coaster ride due to what she's suffering from and suffering with, and trying to really help bring these two unlikely people together.
Yeah, she's very much the glue that binds them. And she seems throughout, she has a wisdom to oversee, you know, this kind of relationship, because it is a trio, but it is also, I do feel like it is chiefly about Paul Hunnam and Angus Tully. You know, they're maybe just a step in front, but I like the role that Randolph has, because she just seems to have this wisdom with people, and she's going through some difficult stuff, but like, I appreciated the fact that she was the head of the kitchen. I felt like they could have made the character even more downtrodden, and it would have been like melodramatic, you know. I thought it was good that she was kind of like, to some degree, she was the sort of chief of her domain, and you know, she knew what she was doing. And I just felt like she had this humility that really struck me throughout the movie. You know, she was kind of always had something going on in that place, even when all the children leave. You know, she's still running the kitchen and
also kind of taking care of these two.
Taking care of these two, exactly. Yeah, yeah. It's such a nice meeting of characters, and Alexander Payne's got this great knack for drama films that it's almost like he has like 10% of Wes Anderson, and that's plenty, you know, like where Wes Anderson is too much sometimes, but that little deadbeat humor that Anderson's so good at, Alexander Payne has like a little, he kind of uses like a little garnish of that in his films, and it's far more subtle, but there's still this kind of slightly wacky sense of, you know, there's always a few quirky little moments. Like I remember the recovery of the wallet in Sideways, or the car keys. There's something, they have to go back and get them from this woman's house, you know, and then the husband runs out completely naked and chases after them. And I remember, you know, some craziness, like the guy getting stung by the bee in Election. There's just, it's very grounded and it feels very real, but there'll always be like a little bit of an element of craziness to it. And I don't know, I really like what he does. He's got a very deft touch when he's doing his best work that I really appreciate. Yeah, and this was just it's one of those films that no one asked for, you know, but it was just what we needed, like a cozy, intelligent kind of Christmas movie.
Yeah, I mean, even when I saw the trailer, like, and I rewatched it, and it just dawned on me that it was like, you know, cut like a 70s trailer. And when I saw it, I kind of just thought, okay, you know, that looks serviceable, but I didn't have any interest until I think when Giamatti and Randolph started winning the awards. So it was like, oh, maybe I'm missing out on this. Yeah, it's true. It is something that no one was asking for. And a lot of movies like this now, even like something big like Killers of the Flower Moon, all these dramas, no one's really going to see in the theaters. They drop on the streamers quickly, but it's nice that they're being recognized. Some people don't like that, you know, that they think more of the popcorn fare and the spectacles should get more recognition. But without these awards, no one would know about them. Or no one would see them,
right?
And I think, and Payne also had some ups and downs with trying to get films made because downsizing tanked, right? So then, you know, like so, yeah. He had Election, which supposedly Obama told him twice that that's his favorite political movie, and I think Payne, there's a sequel to the book that Payne might try to adapt if he can.
Okay.
But I agree with you. He's, you know, he doesn't create films like other filmmakers or many. Like there's no Video Village for this movie. The cast and the writers got together 2 weeks prior to shooting and filming to really develop the backgrounds of these characters. I know Divine Randolph took great pains to really, and it shows on the screen, to do the research, not just about what was going on in era, but also the reason why I think this is contemporary is because you have people of color in this movie. I think if it was made in the 70s, you wouldn't see all of this.
No,
you wouldn't see them
at all. I thought exactly the same thing.
You wouldn't see them peppered in. You wouldn't see that much. No. You might see the kitchen staff. You might see the janitor, but they wouldn't have maybe any speaking lines or roles, or, you know, they'd be sidelined. And as I said earlier, that this was a very personal movie for, you know, both writers, but Payne based her character off his mother. It's basically his mother was someone who sacrificed so much for him. I mean, she was a single mom. So Payne's mother sacrificed a lot for him. But then what happens when there's that mother has a tremendous loss? And then you see that, you know, showcased in different ways throughout the movie, and just different scenes showcase Randolph's range, where encapsulates a different aspect of the stages of grief. Sometimes they blend it together. but every time you see her on screen, she's a different person in terms of how she's trying to deal with this situation. And because the way he films, there's not a lot of discussion, and also the way the actors bonded, I mean, it seems to be genuine in terms of the camaraderie and how much they care about each other and trust each other. And speaking of trust, you have Dominique Sessa, who's basically come out of nowhere. They, for the Tully Angus part, they had auditioned 800 people, couldn't find anyone. So then they started going to the local schools in the area, and then they found Sessa at a boarding school. They filmed at his boarding school, some parts of it. And then they just threw him in, and it came down to a well-known actor and Sessa. Giamatti saw Sessa on like on one of the reels and, you know, thought that this is the kid. He also looks like he's from the 70s. And then and then Randolph was like, oh, well, if you have to, you know, the more interesting choice is someone who's an unknown. And then Payne worked with him one-on-one and personally to help him get up to snuff. And so
you know, can almost see it in the performance, you know, because the character is at turns cocky and completely unsure of himself, you know. So I wonder how much of that is being channeled in the performance. Yeah, I mean, it's beyond a gimmick, but they definitely went to great lengths in the way they wrote the script, the way they filmed, the way they, I'm sure they digitally altered things to make it look like a 1970s film. The music, even the contemporary songs that they've chosen, sound like songs from the 70s. I think the song that opens it is actually from a record from about 2 years ago, but it sounds like it could have been written in 1972. Clearly, Alexander Payne is a huge fan of Hal Ashby, but he never really parodies Hal Ashby. But I was certainly thinking of Harold and Maude and The Last Detail when I was watching this film. Offbeat, kind of meandering style, you know, a lot of nice, just long takes on like windows and snow falling and that patient kind of feel. And something I noticed, which felt like a nod to the 70s, scenes where there's a song playing and the characters are talking, but we can't hear what they're saying. I don't know why, but that really made me think of a bygone era. And it's it's a style that anyone could do now if they wanted to, but it just doesn't seem like something that really happens anymore. And it really put me in the era. If anything, Paul Giamatti probably pulls you out of it more than anything else because he's such a recognizable actor. But, you know, I mean, he's great. Like, I don't think anyone else would have fit that role quite so well. So, you know.
It was written for him. And also you were talking about the look, like the dissolves as well. It took great pains to create this aesthetic, but also I think Payne was influenced by a couple of modern movies who tried to do the same thing, but I can't recall the names of the movies. I think one was called The Bait. I can't remember the other one, if that's accurate. Yeah, it was something that that came out of nowhere for me, and I really enjoyed. I should watch some more of his movies, but I think Election's probably the Sideways and Election are probably the biggest two that I can recall. I'm not sure.
Schmidt as well,
and then he directed Nebraska. And he directed the pilot episode of Hung. I don't know if you ever watched that.
That's what will be on his gravestone, I'm sure. No, for sure. I mean, I think what I really like about Alexander Payne is I watched Election a couple of times for sure, but I think he's the kind of filmmaker who I watch his films once and I really enjoy them, and then I just kind of wait 3 or 4 years for another one. Like, I remember enjoying About Schmidt. I remember enjoying Nebraska, Sideways. Maybe I watched Sideways twice, but, you know, they just kind of kept me engaged, made me think about the characters and stuck with me. But yeah, I had no great desire to go back and watch them 5 or 6 times and kind of, you know, observe every frame and every nuance, although I'm sure you could do that with his movies. He's a director that removes himself, I think, you know, removes traces of himself from the film. And I think that is a trait that has been dead for many years in filmmaking. You know, I feel like generally directors want to draw attention to themselves as much as possible. And I think that there were directors in the 70s that were amazing at that. And they weren't necessarily making you look at the frame. And, you know, there are amazing directors who absolutely force you to know that you're watching a movie and see how incredible the cinematography is or how well they've edited it. But I just think it's interesting sometimes when a director kind of tries more to remove the traces of themselves and just lets you, you know, dissolves that layer between you and the film to some degree. And I think Alexander Payne can definitely do that. And I'm here for directors making movies that you know, look like they're from the 70s. I mean, we've definitely had enough aping of the 1980s. So I don't know. I think I'm done with that.
But there's also, Payne likes to cast comedians into for dramatic roles. I think it's like, you know, just like we talk about, well, The Bear is supposedly a comedy. I would say more of a dramedy or a drama with funny elements, but like Sopranos or what have you, there's comedy and reality. And he seems to know that like comedians can thread that line between drama and comedy. And then just going back to Randolph, and we were talking about people of color in the film. That was something that she wanted to keep that make the audience aware, but keep it subtle. And I think it also explains her distance from Tully and Hunnam. So it's interesting. It's something that will go back and watch with my kids. Like they saw part of it, but I think there's something they really enjoy, but also can relate to in many ways. And I can relate to some of this. I can relate to being Hunnam at times with my kids, and there definitely can be Tully, right? So I do think that it's something I just want to, you know, watch all the way through with them. And supposedly in the liquor store scene, I think that the guy behind the counter was also just a guy behind the counter. Like I think he was just someone who works at the store. So I think it's just mining the reality and the humor. And, you know, I wouldn't call the movie necessarily bleak by any means, but I mean, again, everyone's dealing with something, and I think, you know, there's humor in that and just showcasing the growth that we all require, but just knows how to get the best out of everyone, including just unknowns, more or less.
He had a great line, the guy in the liquor store, didn't he? Like, without spoiling anything, like he's clearly overheard the conversation that the two characters are having as they walk in, and he just throws in this great little line, which really, I think that was one of the moments I cracked up at the most, because it was just so well observed and so kind of off the cuff. Yeah, I love it when directors do that. And you know, I think you can always feel that authenticity. I feel like the camera often looked at members of the public more in old films, or just incredibly talented extras. But I feel like there was often just little snippets of passers-by. It used to be a bit of a trend in the 70s and into the 80s, I think, where like a second unit would just go out and get some footage of the streets, whether they were in New York or LA or Philadelphia or Boston or even cities that aren't in America. It's something that immediately gives a film a real touch of authenticity, that location shooting. And it's something that, again, is missing from a lot of modern films because, yeah, it's a lot to control. You know, I understand why it's difficult to do, but it's so much more effective for me, at least. You know, it's what I grew up with. You know, it just puts me in the reality of the place a lot more. Even if you go back to like old TV shows, a lot of them, you know, when they went outside, they were shooting on location, and it just did give it a kind of earthiness and a grittiness that I think is missing sometimes in a lot of contemporary cinema.
Yeah, but you can see again with some of the things that we discussed, like with True Detective, and it's being filmed in ice on all the snow, that like -9 below zero, you know, temperatures, how it impacts the actors because it brings more of that reality, right? Mm. Or like the globe trotting and, you know, the New York and Mr. and Mrs. Smith. And in this movie, the same. The snow is real. They're going through Boston. They're going into Boston suburbs. They're in, actually in schools. They're in boarding schools.
Yeah.
And it helps not just for the reality, you know, the audience, but, you know, to bring that to life. I mean, it helps inform the actors, and I think it just helps propel
Definitely.
That performance when they're in the middle of it. And so you can see it and you feel that all over the screen, if it's on a locale and not a soundstage, or, you know, in the middle of the volume, you know, it's, you can feel the 70s because where they were going, you know, they were there, and we see it and we feel it with them. We're there with them. And then also, I think as you were saying about the camera, like getting no Hunnam, where you can see the disgusting dirty, like the camera lingers on the disgusting dirty preparation H like in the yeah. bathroom. It's just like stomach churning, or, you know, like, you know, or the bricks in the wall, and, you know, like within the I assume it's the school's church or cathedral. It's the lingering camera definitely just informs the audience of so much. And again, mining the humor, you know, in the midst of like tragedy in some ways.
Heartbreak. Every member of staff, I think, in the first 20 minutes or so of the movie had some kind of bottle of alcohol on their desk, you know, whether it was open or not. But it, you know, and the cigarettes being smoked by certain characters, like, yeah, it just, it puts you in there. But it's great storytelling. And I think there was a trend towards quick cutting and moving cameras, you know, that started to build and build probably in the late 70s through the 80s and 90s. But the other approach is well-placed props, you know, like, as you point out, the preparation H, like it's comical, but it also tells you something about the character, you know, and it also tells you something about probably where the character's frame of mind is, if they're sitting on some hemorrhoids as they grade papers,
or just leaving it out.
Just leaving it out. Yeah, exactly. Like, I love that, you know, when someone has the time to go through and really place the props and just let the camera linger for a bit and just see if the audience picks it up or not. You know, if you miss it, you miss it. But, you know, there was loads of little touches like that throughout that, yeah, just like you say, I felt very in the movie, and it wasn't the coziest place, and it wasn't always the coziest environment. I mean, it's an empty boarding school in winter, but the people brought you in, and just feeling like you were actually in this world where they'd gone to great lengths to make Boston look like Boston in the 70s, or the local bar in the town, you know, like it was very, very convincing throughout. So good job to the production design team, because I bought it.
Yeah. And then even I think just the authenticity of the realities of being a teacher, and just the, you know, you can see some of that coming to a head at the end, the very end, and to be subtle, like just the character's body language and the reality of the situation of, you know, teachers and students. It's impactful. And it just reminded me of something that Martin Landau said. Like, I just saw this clip on Instagram where he was saying, like, you know, something to the effect of like chastising actors who like bawl their eyes out or act drunk. And he said, you know, in reality, people don't want to see you drunk, or they don't want to cry. So real acting is trying not to cry, and, you know, and trying not to be drunk and not having people see you. And I think, and you see that throughout this movie.
Yeah.
Just people holding back their emotions. It's extremely like well done film.
Okay. Well, we've covered 5 great texts there, I would say. I don't think you'd be disappointed if you chose any of them by the sounds of things. What are you looking forward to in the coming weeks and months, BC?
My kids saw that Oppenheimer's on Peacock when I was watching The Holdovers, and they're trying to sneak and watch it. So there's been a big push in the house to watch Oppenheimer. So I think that's coming to the forefront. I'm not sure. I mean, I'm in the middle, I'm watching Curb week to week. But there's nothing else that I know that's really on the horizon. I think it's primarily watching Oscar Fair. Just so many movies that, I've recently learned about and that I want to catch up and watch probably before the awards ceremony. I think Saltburn is on the list, Oppenheimer, and, Anatomy of a Fall, a couple mm-hmm. others that I might try to get to. In terms of TV shows, nothing really comes to mind.
Not The Bad Batch?
Oh, yeah, that's dropping, isn't it? I think that drops this week, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it's the end of the week.
Yeah, so Bad Batch.
It's a good one with the children.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, Bad Batch. And also probably The Marvels again, got panned in the theaters and now is on streaming. Everyone seems to like it. Everyone's like, it wasn't as bad and didn't deserve the hate. So that's something, but that's really been on the back burner. Like, I've been just pushing that. There's just so many more things that I want to watch. But yeah, The Bad Batch is a good one. How about yourself?
Excellent. Yeah, I mean, I'll definitely be catching The Bad Batch. I really enjoy watching all of those shows with my sons. Oppenheimer, but I'm going to wait a little bit longer because finally it's being released, I believe, in Japan in March. So I'll probably hold out to see it on the big screen because I've lasted this long. And I'm working my way through The Righteous Gemstones at the moment. Probably I will catch The Curse at some point and let you know what I think of that.
Oh, man.
But yeah. Okay. So quite a few. So we'll definitely have something to talk about next time we meet.
Yeah, I might have to try to, now that you're watching The Righteous Gemstones, I'm like, oh, that's something. Again, another comedy. It's hard for me to get through comedies. To start them, watch a couple episodes, and then it's hard for me to stick with them. But yeah, that's another one I gotta watch.
Definitely. And you need to catch up on Eastbound and Down while you're at it.
Yeah, I got to watch that last season. And I've been slowly, it's painful, but I think I got over the hump. Like, I was never, in the 90s, there was the Spider-Man cartoon as well as X-Men. They just dropped a trailer for X-Men 97. And I, at the time, even in the 90s, I wasn't a fan of the animation from either of them. But I think I might suffer through both of those shows. Well, definitely the X-Men to see this, see the continuation. Suffered through it a little bit yesterday and got over that hump. So maybe I'll continue to watch it. But it brought a lot of original creators and voice actors back, as well as a new show runner who I've watched on Instagram. And because he's a person of color, and he's also gay. And I think that's what the X-Men was all about. It was just about, as people say, it was, they're very upset that X-Men 97 is woke, even though I think that was the whole premise of X-Men was being was woke before woke was a thing. So I want to see what this creator can bring to the table. So I want to just catch up and watch it if I can.
Excellent. All right. Well, you'll be keeping busy then. And thank you so much for listening. If you are interested in social media and you understand it, you probably understand it better than I do. You can find Dr. Welp on Instagram. I've also started a line in what my son told me is, what did he call me? He said, "You're a green screen kid, Dad." So apparently I'm a green screen kid now with my TikTok movie reviews. I'd appreciate some support there if you want to check out me talking over posters of a movie or a TV show. You can find that on TikTok. My handle is Dr. Welp. What about you, BC? Where can we hunt you down on the social media?
I'm primarily active on Threads, BC Noir on Threads and Instagram. I post occasionally on Instagram. And then I'm always engaging and following and trying to elevate other creatives if possible and when possible. And then I'm on Twitter, so I check that occasionally. On Twitter, I'm Who Is BC Noir, and I'm also BC Noir on Blue Sky, which is just right now just a dead zone. So I try to post
say
on
hi all to Christopher Walken. Can.
And I will. So yeah, I would say primarily on Threads, just give a follow when you can, and hopefully you'll see more of my work to come, not just the podcast but other works in progress. It'll be more active on Instagram shortly.
Fantastic. Well, thank you, BC.
Oh yeah, last I'm watching also Masters of the Air. That's worth watching.
Oh, Masters of the Air. Yeah, of course. I still need to watch Band of Brothers, but that's another story.
What? Are you serious? Oh my God.
I'm all
serious.
Right,
well, if you like the Pacific and Band of Brothers.
I haven't watched any of them.
Really?
Anyway, on that bombshell, yeah, really. I'll be keeping my good eye out for you. And thanks for listening. I'm Dr. Welp, and he's BC Noir. Thank you and good night.
See you on the flip side.